Hello, I'm Mariette Snyman. Thank you for joining Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others, introducing you to a wide range of wellness professionals ready to inform and inspire. Today's topic is chronic pain or illness, coping with day-to-day life. My guest is Marina Wildt, wellness coach specializing in chronic illness and pain management from Johannesburg. Welcome, Marina.
Thank you so much for having me, Mariette.
To our listeners, during our conversation, Marina will recommend some healthy daily habits that can encourage healing, and then it will be fun question time. Marina, would you please introduce us to your work?
Thank you so much, Mariette. Yes, so my name is Marina, and I'm the founder of an organization called HEAL. At HEAL, we focus on helping people with chronic illness and chronic pain find daily tools and practical ways to cope with life so that when you leave the doctor's office after a diagnosis, when you need to find ways to reintegrate into life and make your way through, you have something to build with and to build on. That's usually where doctors or medics tend to not or stop being able to assist us, and where we need that practical life guidance in order to grow. And I do this in two predominant ways. The first is through coaching and private coaching, and the second is through the HEAL community, which is a massive group of individuals who all in some way struggle with chronic illness. And this support group is there for anybody who wants to join in order to find daily support management tools and tips, just because we all need a support structure.
I'm so glad you're addressing that need. On your website, it says, finding someone who understands your chronic illness journey can be tough. Why do you say this?
That's a very good question, Mariette. I think that there are a couple reasons why it's very challenging for people. But the primary one is that a lot of chronic illnesses, be they physical health or mental health, are invisible. You cannot see them. If I were to see someone take a knife, for example, and hurt you or cut you or something like that, you would see blood, you would see tissue damage, and automatically you see this injury, and when you see the injury, you assume harm, you assume pain, you assume suffering. Now, the trigger for you to have that empathy is the visual impact. But unfortunately, with a lot of conditions, they're entirely invisible, which means that for people to gain empathy or understanding or connection is twofold. Firstly, no one can really see what you're going through. From the outside, you can look almost entirely normal, maybe a little bit tired, but your hair, usually, depending on the condition, doesn't change much, your skin, your body. So it looks, and you tend to look, quite normal. Now, the other part of this is that not everybody has a chronic illness or knows what it means to suffer on a daily basis. And so for people who are coming in with regular doctor's visits, chronic medication, terrible prognoses, awful symptoms, they are experiencing challenges that the average person hasn't had the misfortune of going through. And so being able to connect is very hard. Saying something like, I have chronic pain, which means I have pain that never goes away, and it's not due to an injury, can sound out of this world different to anybody who has, otherwise experienced pain, where they've fallen and injured themselves, they've been in an accident, and you can physically see damage. For someone to come to you and they look perfectly normal and say, hey, I have the worst pain in the world and there's no physical damage to show, it's very hard to at first get people to believe, and second, if they do believe, say, okay, I can kind of get what you need or what you want, because they themselves have never been there. Yeah.
I think today's conversation will really help a lot of us who may not quite understand what it means to suffer chronic pain. A related question, which common misunderstandings regarding chronic illness and pain do we come across?
So the first one I would have to say is, what does it mean to always be in pain or to always be suffering? One of the most common questions I would get through my own story is, how can you be in pain all day? Are you in pain right now in this moment? And the answer every day, any hour you ask me, is yes, I am in pain. And the follow-up is, well, you don't look like you're in pain. You look normal. You look fine. You look healthy. And for me, I've learned in time to say, thank you. I put a lot of work into being able to manage my health the way I do. But it doesn't mean I'm not suffering. It means I'm managing the suffering well. So the first misconception a lot of the time is, but you don't look sick. But you don't look like there's an issue. But you look perfectly healthy. That's one of the first things that people say. And even if it maybe comes from a good place around maybe saying that you're looking well in a good way, it can come across for a lot of people as, and the way it's sometimes meant as, okay, but is this really all that bad? You look like you're potentially faking this. So that's one of the first things that happens. After that, I would say that another big misconception or issue around it is how many different facets of your life that ends up impacting. So a lot of chronic illnesses, especially the ones that I work with, which range from autoimmunity, also neuropathic pain, cancer pain, all these kinds of conditions, they tend to have a range of symptoms that may not be directly related to the condition itself. And a lot of those symptoms can be fatigue, brain fog, hypersensitivity to sound, color, light. It can also result in mental health conditions, starting things like depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder. So a big difficulty comes in with saying, hey, once I have a foundation of a chronic illness, it can result in a lot of different symptoms. And just because I may have neuropathic pain, meaning pain that is due to a nervous system condition or nervous system related, doesn't mean that I won't be feeling effects in other ways in my life. And the things do link, it's just the links are not obvious. So a lot of people struggle with memory loss, with fatigue, with brain fog. And those are all in some way related to chronic illness issues. They're just not directly obvious. So that's another big misconception, I'd say. And probably the last one I would say, which is quite interesting, is again going back to how people tend to believe or know things to be acute. So an acute illness or an acute condition means that it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So when we get the flu, for example, we know that we're going to get better. And so we wish people, hey, get better soon. I hope you feel better. And when someone breaks their leg, we go, oh, no, man, I'm so sorry. Go to the doctor, get a cast, take some Panado, some Myprodol, and it'll get better. It will heal. The concern with chronic conditions is that they can improve, but for the most part, chronic conditions are there to stay. And one thing we tend to struggle with a lot is people coming in and either saying, well, when are you going to get better? When is it going to be over? Or, and I hate to say it, but when are you going to die? A lot of people have throughout my life asked me, well, if I'm not going to get better, when am I going to die? And this concept that you can live with it for so long, you can live with it your whole life, is very hard to get your head around because it's just so unusual for a lot of us.
You've referred to your own experience of chronic illness and pain. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us your story, which started at 16?
Yes, actually, I can. So if I may, I've shared a lot of my story from age 16, but it actually goes back 2 years before that, to when I was 14. And I had just started high school. This is, I think it's grade eight. And basically, I was a very typical A-type scholar. So this means I was very driven, very competitive, quite perfectionistic. I really enjoyed doing well and getting good grades and succeeding. And towards the end of my eighth grade year, I started to feel incredibly sick, and my right leg was very sore. And we could not understand what was happening, but every time I played sports, it would get worse. And so eventually it got to a point where I could not move my right leg anymore. And we went in for physio, maybe I'd torn something playing netball or running. And when the physio looked at this, he kind of just went, oh gosh, no, this is not a standard injury. And we went for an x-ray, and they found at that point a 13 centimeter long tumor that was growing out of my femur, my right femur, right by my kneecap. And this was around the time that I was under a lot of pressure writing my first set of high school exams. The doctor, the surgeon, came through. He said, look, this is quite serious. It's quite badly damaging your muscle in that area. We need to operate by the end of this week. And so at the time, my leg had sustained quite a lot of traumatic injury from the tumor breaking through the muscle. And I went and did the surgery. They removed the tumor. It was successful. No cancer. We were fine. And in recovery from that, this was in November, I was expected to be walking again by February, so a three-month recovery. And by the time February came of the following year, I was still in agony. And I was not even close to being able to walk. April came and I was still on crutches. May came and I was still on crutches. And every time I would go back to the orthopedic surgeon or see someone or the physio, they couldn't understand why the swelling wasn't going down, but there was no injury, nothing went wrong from the surgery, everything was fine, my pain was excruciating, and the swelling would not go down. And no one could understand why. What was then perceived by me at the time, a 15-year-old high school girl, was that I was just a bit of a hypochondriac, maybe a bit of a wuss or a baby. I couldn't handle pain. And so it was just told to me to brush it off. Now, in that year, in that ninth grade year up until for about just over 12 months to the end of 10th grade, I used to take my pocket money and run to Dis-Chem after school to buy Myprodol. And I was spending majority of my pocket money going through maybe 3 or 4 boxes of Myprodol a week, just trying to ease that pain. And no one, I couldn't really tell anybody, because who would firstly believe me? And secondly, then who would tell me that I'm not an addict, a forming addict? So I was very secretive about how much medication I took at the time. I was in a lot of pain. And I was slowly able to get off the crutches for a small period of time. But by the end of grade 10, around September of that year, so now we're looking at about 2 years since the initial injury. We started this journey in the end of grade 8. Now we're looking at the end of grade 10. I've gone through that entire period just hobbling on and off crutches, in and out of, you know, being in hospital or at home, in and out of taking sick leave, and taking a copious amount of medication to try and manage it. Especially remembering that at this time as well, my biggest goal or my biggest desire was to do well and achieve well in school. So I was going through a lot of feelings of distress because of just how much I wanted to do well. And the more pressure I put on myself, the worse I got. So by the end of the 10th grade, I had an incident where I fell down a flight of stairs at school. And at this point, I could feel my legs were not good. This was real pain. I hobbled to a teacher. I called my mom. I said to her, look, I've fallen and I don't think it's going to be good. Mariette, it took me 2 weeks and I woke up one morning completely paralyzed from my waist down. I couldn't feel my right leg at all. My left leg was very weak. My hips were not able to move. And at this point, there was something, I mean, this result was it. My parents said, okay, this is enough. Let's go for the 20th opinion and let's see what's going on, because she's not lying. So he rushed me to another doctor who was finally able to diagnose me with the condition I have, which is a rare degenerative nerve disease called complex regional pain syndrome, or shortened, it's CRIPS. CRIPS is considered, on a global standpoint, by the McGill University Pain Index and Scale, as the most painful chronic condition in the world. It rates at about a 46 to a 48 out of 50 on the scale, where unplanned childbirth sits at about a 38 and limb amputation at about a 42. And so my case, by the point they'd already diagnosed me, was very severe. And the degeneration from that point was rapid. So I lost all mobility in my right leg. Movement and the pain was so excruciating that for about 2 years, I could not even withstand the pressure of having a shower, and that pressure of the shower water touching me. I was in agony. We had to, for about 2 years, take a wet cloth and very gently wring it over my legs, and no touching. If you touched it, I would cry. So we went through 2 years of probably the worst pain I could ever imagine. At that point, the doctor also said, look, you know, it's remarkable you even managed with Myprodol. At this point, she put me on morphine patches twice a day. She put me on enough Tramacet or other opioids to keep me going, about 8 of those a day with the morphine, and muscle relaxants, nerve relaxants, the whole bomb, just try and get my body to calm down. Because if you can imagine pain of that level that never goes away, it means that you never sleep. It means that you can't eat. It means that you can't think. It's a very raw form of torture. And unfortunately, because of this, the suicide rate for CRIPS is about 75 to 80%. It is considered the suicide disease because there is no way to recover. There's no way, there's no formula for healing with it. You've got some treatments that can assist with the symptoms and some that may be able to lower the pain periodically. But there's no medication, this or that, that can effectively heal the condition. So you have to learn to live with it. And that was my first diagnosis. It changed the course of my life because after that I had to drop out of school for a long time and focus on recovery of some form. And I had to decide or start to make sense for myself what recovery looked like. And for many years, for me, and even the word recovery to this day doesn't sit well, because it was never about that. It was just saying, okay, how can I learn to make my life a little bit better every day? How can I find a way to manage the pain a little bit better each day? And it was challenging. I had to stop school. I had also, beyond the fact that I couldn't concentrate long enough to string a sentence together, I would have never been able to write matric. And I also was feeling very, very different emotions to the rest of my peers my age, whom at the time had, and rightly so, a massive focus on grades, school, boys, parties, matric, varsity. And my focus was now, one, am I going to be in this much pain for the rest of my life? And two, am I ever going to walk again? And so I had to change what I was doing in order to start that healing journey. So that was the start of the journey. And one, there were a couple of things that were monumental for me in my process of healing. But the one was, after I started all the meds, was that my doctor suggested, look, I think it's time you see a psychologist. And I have one who specializes in chronic pain and chronic illness management. And so I went to see him. And to this day, we are still very close and connected, although I haven't been under his care since 2019. But he changed my life tremendously, because at the time, and this was a long time ago, this was well over 15, 16 years ago now, he started to introduce me to the fact that although we cannot get rid of your condition, we can teach you to be an incredibly empowered patient who knows how to understand and manage their body. And so that really was a big turning point in my recovery, although that turning point I could possibly say was about 5 years long. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's the origin story.
Mm-hmm. It really sounds to me as if this simply plunges one into despair.
Yeah, absolutely. I never had anxiety or depression before, but I was, after my diagnosis, then diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and depression. So it definitely does. I don't know how else to say it other than it feels like torture, because for years, and for a lot of us who have chronic illness, we spent a great deal of years trying to figure out what's wrong. It's not easy to get that diagnosis. And once you have that diagnosis, more often than not, that that moment where the doctor says, you have this, you tend to leave feeling validated and safe because you know something's really wrong. And so when someone says, hey, we've got an answer, even if that answer is as bad as this, I still left there feeling better because I could finally say to myself, you're not crazy. You're not crazy. This is real. What you're going through is real. And a lot of that anxiety that was built over so many years going, maybe I am just a hypochondriac. Maybe I don't know how to handle myself. Maybe what's wrong with me? Am I seeking attention? And so all those years of misunderstandings tend to all come to something that says, hey, no, you're right. Your cries for help are valid. And so there's a huge moment of relief. And from that point on, being able to cope with the condition then brings that second set of issues. Number one, you yourself have suffering that no one else can see. You yourself have suffering that very few people can ever understand. And once you leave the doctor's rooms, you kind of get given a bit of a pat on the back and sent off saying good luck, because their job is not to help you manage your life. Their job is to try and get you stable medically. And so their expertise ends with what medication and treatments or surgeries are possible to assist the patient. And this holds a huge amount of power, and I respect and value my doctors tremendously. But it does mean that you're then thrown into life going, oh God, how am I going to do this? And that brings a lot of despair.
And this experience of yours led you to what you are doing now. Could you outline that for us?
Of course. So after my primary diagnosis, I spent many years trying to recover. And eventually, I would say by the time I was about 21, I had managed to, with the work of my psychologist, with my occupational therapist, and with a incredible curiosity to grow and understand what I was going through, along with one or two doctors that were willing to take risks and listen to me, I was slowly able to build a beautiful community around me that allowed me to make progress. My doctor spoke to my psychologist, who spoke to my occupational therapist, who spoke to so-and-so, my hydrotherapist, and they all built this bubble around me with my parents as my caregivers, where every single thing was tracked, and I took a lot of accountability in monitoring that process. And so I was able to see improvement. My psychologist helped me take initiative to realize that it was my journey to hone in on and you know, just start. And everybody else was there to assist me as I learned and I grew. And these conditions can be managed through lifestyle changes like diet, exercise, stress management is a massive one. And beyond that, a huge amount of patient accountability and self-awareness around what is it that makes you sore? What are the things that make your pain worse? What are the things that make it better? What are the things that make you stressed? How does stress affect your pain? What do you do on a day-to-day basis that can make things a whole lot easier, and what makes it harder? And so I started to build, you know, a really good routine around the medication I took, my work with my psychologist, and building my healing process. And it allowed me effectively to start working, to finish my studies, to finish high school and to start working, which was lovely. And when I was able to get back into work, I started working in health because I always wanted to be in health as a kid. It was always going to be medicine for me. And I realized after this diagnosis that medicine was no longer a possibility, not because of any other reason other than I physically cannot withstand that much physical pressure as I go around a hospital or withstand that many sleepless nights studying. It wasn't sustainable, and I understood that. So I was given an opportunity to work in health, but through journalism. And I started at about the age of 20, 21. And it was wonderful, you know. My boss took a chance on this high school graduate in journalism that didn't have a degree, and she really thought I could do it, and I loved it. It was great. Within 4 years, I was managing the entire magazine, and I'm very proud of that. But what was very true of the time was that although I'd built a greater understanding of my own body, I was still very much in a go-go-go space. And that meant that I was still highly competitive. I put a lot of pressure on myself. And by the time I was building as an editor, I was going to bed at like 1 or 2 in the morning, waking up at 5, getting into the office by 6:30. I was going crazy hours trying to manage a lot on a very limited staff base. And it, you know, in retrospect, some of it could have been better, shared. The workload could have been better shared, but I felt a big need to take on that accountability and to do everything myself. And I was still unaware of just how much stress was a massive part of why I was sick to begin with. And I thought that I could just carry on with almost a bit of an addiction to that go, go, go. I loved that go, go, go. I loved that high I got from pushing and achieving, pushing and achieving. However, every time I did that, I put my body under a huge amount of stress. And with that stress, what I didn't realize was that my body wasn't happy. And there were small signs that showed me this that I ignored. For example, burnout. For example, headaches, migraines. I was getting weekly migraines, gut issues, IBD, back pain. I wasn't well. And I learned a lesson around this time in my early 20s, which is that if you don't stop to listen to your body when it's trying to tell you that it's under pressure or it's not coping, your body is going to choose a time to stop. And it's often not going to be at a time that is convenient to you. And that's what happened to me. I was 23 when I was diagnosed with cervical cancer. I needed to go again and have emergency surgery to remove the tumor. And then just a year later, I was then diagnosed with lupus, fibromyalgia, and Raynaud's phenomenon. And at this point, when these last three diagnoses came, I had to stop. I had to stop, and I had to, stop working. I was once again bedbound, once again very reliant on my crutches, once again, just not able to really move or do anything. And it was at this point for myself that I said, okay, I think I've got about 50% of the formula here, but when they say you really need to focus on your body and you really need to learn how to introspect and you really need to learn to be self-aware and you really need to respect what your body is telling you, I finally started to get it. Now, by this point at age 23, 24, when I stopped everything, I'd already been doing this chronic illness thing for 10 years. And so there were a thing or two I knew about how to live life with chronic illness. And so my coaching career and the business I have now started out as a, hey, let me blog and share my stories. And it started out with me just going, hey guys, if you've got chronic pain and the weather's cold, here's some stuff that will help. Or if you are trying to cook with pain, here's some stuff that'll help. Or if you're going to your doctor and you don't know what to ask and you're nervous, here's some suggestions. Or this is how I'm feeling today. This is how bad it is. This is what I've done. And this is what I need just to just relax and be compassionate to myself. And slowly the response was, thank you for sharing tips that doctors can't. Thank you for giving advice that only comes from a seasoned patient. Thank you for sharing your vulnerability about how difficult it is to do this. Because one thing I must say that's been a beautiful gift that I'm honored to have gotten in my life is the ability to communicate. Communication is a strong skill of mine. And so although there are many others that are lacking, especially moderating your intake of activities and being one of them, communicating has been good. And so I decided to use that as a vessel to share some input and advice for people. And the response was, thank you for putting into words what we have found difficult to say. And thank you for helping us connect and communicate with the people who love us so that we know what to tell them. And finally, thank you for giving us practical advice that we would have never thought of. And it didn't take long for someone to say at this point, do you coach? Do you actually help people with this? And I'd been toying with this idea, you know, growing up, as I said, it was medicine, and there was part of me that always touched on that side of psychology around this. And I said, you know what? Medicine has played a huge role in helping me heal. But it was only a percentage of the journey. I could have never done this without my psychologist, and he was also a coach, who helped me not only process everything, process the traumas, process the things that had also potentially led to me being as unwell as I have been. And then on top of that, coaching me through a couple of ways to build on my life. And I said to myself, geez, you know, this feels like what's right. This is what I need to be doing. And so I took whatever savings I had and I spoke to my parents and I said, look, at the time I was finishing a business degree, I'm like, I'm doing coaching now. And so I started on the coaching and I started qualifying, and it was really humbling because so many people that had started following me through the journey had said, look, we know you're qualifying, but can we just talk to you? Can we get your advice? Like, you know, charge a minimal fee, but we want to start. And so it was so special, and I started that process then. And so that's been 6 years ago now. And such a humbling and beautiful experience. Wow. What it also made me slowly believe and see was that it would be a serious pity if I didn't try and at least qualify in a counseling or a psychology background as well. So it's been a recent pursuit of mine to complete that study. And so it is what I'm currently doing while I coach and run my coaching practice. But yes, this has been the journey that's led to me starting Heal and helping people around this. It's giving a voice for people who struggle to speak, having or creating that safe space for people who feel like there's no way to turn. And then hopefully just allowing people to see that they're not crazy, they're not alone. Yeah, their struggles are not ignored or unaccounted for. We're here, and we're here because we're going through it. It's now only been officially 4 years that I have not used any walking aid. So I let go of my last use of my crutch in beginning, middle 2020. And I have not used it since. And I'm very honored that a lot of my approach and what I've learned through this journey about managing illness has proven to be effective in the way that my overall health is now. I not only then let go of my crutch, but qualified in as a yoga instructor and incorporate a lot of Eastern philosophies in my practice, particularly those around meditation and mindfulness, because of the fact that they help bring awareness to the body and help a person introspect. So I found that a very powerful tool to incorporate as a coach. And then beyond that, I wanted to prove something, which is that healing is an incredibly uncomfortable journey. And it's uncomfortable because we start to identify partly with the conditions we have. Once you have diabetes or an autoimmune like lupus, multiple sclerosis, or something of that nature, it becomes so much our identity in how we manage our day-to-day lives, the doctors we see, the activities we do, the foods we eat. And so this process of healing is uncomfortable, not only because it means that you want to push through some really hard stuff, but it means that you are willing to accept that healing or going forward is unknown, because you will never, unfortunately, be able to go back to the person you were before the diagnosis. You have to move forward into a part of you that hasn't been formed yet, and that's scary. Growth is scary for all of us. So if you choose to say, hey, I want to build on my recovery, what you're also accepting at that point is that you don't know what the future you is going to look like. And as scary as that is, you are willing to put your time and effort into growing that version of yourself that you don't even know yet over repeating the current cycle of distress you're in. And repeating the current cycle of distress you're in may not be actively what you think you want, and it may not be what you really want. You may really want to go back to who you used to be, but unfortunately, that version of you doesn't exist anymore. And although it's distressing doing doctor's medication and repeating and going round in circles, it is also a pattern that you do get used to. And it becomes a place of safety because you can start to identify with that part of you. So when you choose to heal, or when you choose to move beyond, or say, hey, if I don't have this illness, what would I look like? Knowing I've already gone through this. That's hella scary, because that means that you're now going to part with an identity that traumatized its way into your life and now has handcuffed you to a way of life. And so I took on the challenge also within my healing to start yoga and start doing handstands and headstands and roly-polies, because I wanted to in some way show that firstly, healing is not linear. It can grow in so many different directions. And secondly, it is uncomfortable. But the more you get used to that discomfort of not knowing what the future you may be, the more you are willing to be open to trying and just seeing. And so I didn't start yoga going, hey, let me do handstands. I started yoga when my legs were still paralyzed in my bed saying, let me try wriggle my right toe today. No, let's try again next week. And we went through a year of just trying to get my one foot to move. So that process is long and slow, and you take 3 steps forward and 2 steps back, and it's uncomfortable and it's painful, and you'll want to give up, and you will stop, and you will stop many times, and you'll cry, and you'll give up. And I know that because I've been there. But it's so important to know, and what I want anyone to know who's in that space, is that you really don't have to do it alone. And the objective of what we do is something that I am grateful for my community doing for me, which was very rare, which is that they were able to hold me when I was too weak to hold myself, so that I could then eventually be able to get there.
Yeah, I really don't have the words to express the respect I have for your journey and where you are now.
Thank you.
I would like us to look at chronic pain and illness in more general terms and how to handle it, because that is what you offer people. Mm. So what can you tell us about the possible causes of chronic illness, including trauma and the way it affects the body?
Such a good question. So chronic illness can be triggered or started from a variety of different causes. Now, I speak purely from that lens of not only a patient, I suppose a training psychologist, but a lot of the research I've done and the work I've done. But one of the main causes for chronic illness that we can't overlook, before I get into things like trauma, is genetics. Genetics do play a role. We do find that some people are more genetically predisposed to developing autoimmune conditions, cancer, than others. For example, we know that breast cancer is something that is genetically passed down. So we know that genetics does play a role in this. If we look at my mom has also struggled with IBD and migraines, which both I have too. So we know that. Now, beyond that, we've entered quite a new space in the chronic illness community, which is understanding just how much stress actually impacts us, the ways in which it impacts us, and our lifestyle. For a long time, the majority of studies done on the effects of stress on the human body were conducted on males. And so for a long time, what we understood about how stress affects the human body resulted in what we kind of typically know: hypertension, cancer, high cholesterol, those kinds of conditions. Now, those are all very true and accurate, but predominantly for men. What we haven't really studied a lot, and what has slowly started to be more incorporated since 1997, is studying the effects of stress on the female body, because the female body responds quite differently to stress. And from what I've gathered, and again, I'm speaking from working with medical professionals in this and my understanding through it, but women, because of our hormonal differences, our physiological differences, we handle stress differently to men. And what has been noticed is that the effects of stress on women tend to result in autoimmune problems. Things like Hashimoto's, autoimmunity of the thyroid. We look at things like endometriosis. Also, that's not autoimmunity, but it's a women's health related issue, women's sexual health issue, polycystic ovarian syndrome, thyroid imbalances, hyperthyroidism. We also look at conditions like lupus, multiple sclerosis, and then other things like Sjögren's, Crohn's. We look at a lot of chronic pain conditions, also scoliosis. So what we've noticed is that, and you know, I don't want to misquote, but it is a significantly higher percentage of women who are predisposed to autoimmune conditions and chronic health-related issues of this nature than men. And the predominant cause tends to be stress, long-term stress, and the effects on the body. Now, this stress can be separated and looked at into many different angles, one being trauma. But stress in itself dysregulates your body. If you can imagine, your body really wants to stay in a state of balance all the time. It functions best, it's able to reproduce its cells, it's able to hormonally regulate, it's able to function optimally if your levels of stress are regulated. When your levels of stress are not regulated, it means that you are most likely going to be releasing higher levels of stress hormones, like cortisol and adrenaline. Cortisol as a stress hormone is highly valuable. We all need to be able to produce it. It is responsible for our flight or fight response, which means that in situations where there is potential threat or danger, it helps us decide the best way to get rid of that threat or danger. So cortisol is a valuable hormone and we need it. But the problem is in modern life is that we are being exposed to daily stresses that are causing, that are kind of resulting in our bodies releasing cortisol all the time. And that is not a hormone that's meant to be produced all the time in our bodies. It will have a toxic effect. And it does cause inflammation. And when our internal body is exposed to inflammation, it cannot function as well. And that is a huge reason for chronic illness development, when there is just consistent inflammation due to cortisol release in the body. Now, that is one element. The second, and you brought up trauma, is that trauma, especially from a young age, again, bringing in that whole thing of fight or flight, is that trauma can be from multiple different things, but it effectively means that when you were young or in your founding and formative years, you were exposed to situations that you felt threatened by or you felt were dangerous, could result in, as a little kid, having very high spikes of cortisol release as well. Now, if we look at complex trauma or that kind of thing, what we're actually talking about is a child who's potentially had 3, 4 or more traumatic instances. These can range from highly severe things in the eye of society, like sexual abuse, physical abuse, loss of a parent, alcohol abuse, those kinds of things. But they could also be maybe a little bit less intensive. They could be things like divorce as well. So usually what psychologists have started to say is that when you've had between 3 and 4 traumatic instances as a child, you're quite likely to develop or have a complex trauma response, complex post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, what this means is that as a child, if you're always having these traumatic situations and you're consistently releasing high levels of cortisol because your body wants to protect itself, you want to get that threat to go away, and you don't have the tools needed to regulate, find safety after that instance. The main way children regulate is through co-regulation, meaning body contact, having a parent to hold, having someone to say, it's okay, being able to hear your parent's heartbeat. These are the main forms of co-regulation that teach us how to balance our stress as adults. They help us and they show us how to get back to a balanced state. Now, as children, if we are not given that space to learn how to co-regulate, we not only then have these high levels of cortisol always being released, which are highly toxic for the body, but we're also not given any tools in how to then bring it back down again. And so you find adults who have then had high levels of cortisol in their body, creating a great deal of toxicity, of neurotoxicity as well, that then can result not only in mental health conditions from starting, but also physical health conditions. So I think that it was the American Psychological Association that shared how women, as a result of trauma, especially in foundation years, are more likely to develop chronic conditions such as fibromyalgia. Fibromyalgia is a psychosomatic condition, meaning that it is often it's a psychologically born physical disease. And so trauma born physical condition. So women are highly predisposed to getting conditions like that, IBD, gut issues, headache issues, back issues, as a result of extended periods of unresolved trauma, using unhealthy coping mechanisms to manage life and not knowing how to regulate the nervous system again and come back to a balanced state. Yeah, definitely. So when people find me eventually, we're usually dealing with a bit of a triad, which is a mixture of mental health and physical health conditions, mixed with definitely often either stress that from an adult life perspective around potentially pushing too hard at work, getting into cycles of burnout, putting yourself into dysregulated states all the time that then lead to other health conditions in adulthood, or traumatic instances that have not been managed enough from a young age. And we look at people who live in highly dysregulated bodies that often feel they are unsafe. They are not in safe environments. They don't feel safe. They don't feel loved. They don't feel able to balance and restore equilibrium to their own bodies. And often when we tap into that on both sides, maybe people who are stressed because of work burnout and pressure and all of that, or from life pressure and trauma, the result is often unhealthy coping mechanisms. So we tend to often tie in a link with addiction of some kind too. It's not a hard and fast rule, but if you look at experts in the field like physician Dr. Gabor Maté or psychiatrist Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, they speak extensively about the effects of trauma on the human body, how that often relates into addiction and physical health. So there's a lot of literature around it, and we're seeing it more prevalently. But yeah, look, they do vary. But the fundamental point and what it all comes back to is stress.
Thank you, Marina. I want to talk to you about getting a chronic illness diagnosis. Which challenges are involved in getting a diagnosis you have illustrated from your own life?
So I would have to say that the biggest struggle with a chronic illness diagnosis is often that symptoms are variant and they often don't always add up. They also can be misinterpreted quite often. And doctors may not be able to always put all these puzzle pieces together very easily. So one of the biggest struggles is, oh, I went for blood tests, nothing was detected. I went for this test, nothing was found. Or, you know, we were able to say that they know that I've got gut issues, I get headaches, I've got brain fog, I'm stressed. But that could actually be like 30 chronic conditions. And until the symptoms are severe enough, doctors often are not able to put all those puzzle pieces together. So the difficulty that patients often go through, at least from my experience and then the people that end up coming to me, again, this is very much coming from a personal experience, but it is that they aren't able themselves to put all the puzzle pieces together because they can be so variant and so dependent on one another. You don't really know if you've got gut issues because you've got depression, or the depression is causing the gut issues, which one is symptomatic of which one needs to be medicated, how do you then, you know, test and see what the bloods tell you. I mean, geez, I don't know how many times I did bloods before they were finally high enough, the one antibody count was finally high enough for the doctor to go, okay, lupus. You know, I'd had all the symptoms. I had the red cheeks, the cold sores on my mouth, the swelling, the chest. There's so many symptoms that showed that I had lupus. But until that blood test was finally there, and that took years, I didn't get a diagnosis. And this seems to be a frustration that a lot of people do go through, yeah, which is it's hard to be able to pinpoint all your symptoms. And it does end up having to be treated a bit like that December holiday puzzle that stays on your dining room table for a month, where every now and then you go back and you have to put a piece to make it fit with another. And it doesn't always all make sense. And you often have to go away and think about it and then come back. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when someone does get a diagnosis, then you can guide them in finding balance and direction. Yes. And I also think perhaps when they don't.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. It's not just about when the diagnosis comes, it's also when you don't get the diagnosis. Yeah. Yeah. When you do feel that you're lost because the bloods are inconclusive and the doctors don't know what's happening. As I mentioned to you earlier on in this episode, one of the biggest feelings most chronic illness patients get with a diagnosis is relief that finally they've got an answer. And so being able to learn to trust your body and trust yourself before that diagnosis, learning to be accountable and assertive with your doctor to say, hey, I've tried this, I've got this, I can show you X, Y, Z, is really important, because it takes you out of that position of feeling as though whatever is going on in your body is controlling you, and you are slowly learning how to understand the way your body works.
Yeah, and that leads to my next question, which is about managing chronic health conditions. And I chose three themes from your website.
Mm.
One is working through one's fears. Two is coping with unanswered questions.
Mm.
And three is achieving true lifestyle breakthroughs. So, firstly, what advice do you have concerning working through one's fears?
It's such a good question, and I really appreciate you bringing it up, because it's probably one of the biggest things that we either start with or tend to develop as we embark on a chronic illness journey. But effectively, the fears come in from not knowing what is going on and not having answers as to why. And so you just keep doing your life. And the more you do life, the more your body starts to struggle. And the fear comes in with, oh gosh, what's going to happen next? And then once you do get a diagnosis, different fears set in. Maybe they are a result of Dr. Google. Maybe they are a result of the things that your doctor has told you. But often what you find out isn't nice. And so you also then have to deal with the fact that bad things can happen to you. And to not allow that to get the better of you, all while still giving yourself the space and time to process it, accept it, sit with it, have an incredibly challenging internal conversation with it. And then being able to say, okay, how can I use knowledge to overcome this fear? From there you mentioned, coping with the unanswered questions. And I think that ties in a lot, again, with my puzzle analogy, where people as empowered patients tend to need to go through a journey of saying, I need to be okay with not having all the pieces of the puzzle right now. And in fact, it's part of something I actually share with my clients the minute they start working with me. I have a little booklet or an infographic that I share with them around what it actually means to be an empowered patient, or what it means to be a patient that can heal. And I definitely would love to share that with you. But that first step, that first kind of point, is saying, I accept the fact that this process means I don't have all the puzzle pieces yet. And I'm willing to learn, take a few puzzle pieces, put them aside. And then as I grow and go in my journey, remember and keep those puzzle pieces so I can start to put them all together. So instead of going around this whole thing as, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know, can you go about it saying, okay, there's one more thing I know. Let me put that on the table. There's one more thing I understand here. What can I do with this? So yeah, that's definitely one of them.
And thirdly, then, how can one achieve true lifestyle breakthroughs?
Yeah, another very, very good question. So I think that what I've done in my support group is I've created a HEAL fellowship. So like a bit of a 12 steps pledge around what it means to genuinely choose the path of healing when you are chronically ill. And I won't go into depth around it, but the 12 steps basically are, number one, acknowledge and understand your chronic illness. Go in from a point of view that knowledge can help empower you. The more you understand, the less scared you can be. The second is to respect diverse paths to healing. Healing can look different to everybody, and everybody's own journey with chronic illness will get better because of a very unique and personalized approach. So when you come into the community, come in knowing that some people want Western medicine, others want Eastern, others want a spiritual journey. And I am not here to tell you, I'm not a doctor, I'm not here to tell you what to do. All I'm here to say is that from my experience, diversity tends to be what helps heal. And you need to respect that in each person's journey. The third is that this is a commitment to lifelong self-care. You don't get to wake up every day and choose defiance. You need to be able to see and understand just how much self-care and healing needs to be part of every decision you make. Number four is to seek balance in healing with moderation. One thing I really hate in any approach is a dogmatic kind of coaching where there's a certain way to do things and we push it that way and we only go that way. Balance is key. We're here to show that in order to really get anywhere, we need to regulate, we need to feel safe again, and we need to build based on a foundation of understanding. From there, each path is personalized. No one's journey is identical. You have to support others in the fellowship. Basically, the more you learn, the more you pay back by paying forward and helping the next person on their journey. You build accountability with a buddy system. People are meant to link and connect here, meet for coffee, talk about their journeys and their experiences, and embrace collective wisdom. You are encouraged to pursue a passion or a hobby to remind you that happiness comes from when you start to do things for yourself and figure out what it is that breeds that internal culture of goodness. And then devote yourself to a greater cause, because unlike happiness being an internal thing, purpose is an external one. And so building your hobbies and passions is deeply important from your internal journey, and finding someone or something to devote yourself to on the outside gives you purpose, and both are essential. You need to be able to seek strength beyond yourself. So whatever higher power you choose to connect with, be it a spiritual one or a religious one, you need to be able to build an inner source of strength. resilience and understanding, peace and acceptance through that higher power. And then finally, the last of the 12 steps is to learn to celebrate your small victories, because there are no big steps here, only little ones.
A quick note on what I do. I'm a content entrepreneur creating podcasts and articles on living a happier and healthier life. By interviewing coaches, therapists, and other wellness experts from over the world. You'll find this content on my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, and it's there to help you find just the right helping professional when you need one. This section, Up Close and Personal, on my website, offers you a glimpse of the person behind many of the experts I feature. If you're a wellness expert keen on getting more in-person or online clients, or creating worldwide awareness of an issue close to your heart, let's talk about co-creating a podcast or article, or perhaps featuring you in a South African magazine. You'll find more information under Services on my website. To each listener, no matter your age, occupation, or where you live, how about creating your very own personal audio recording with me as a one-of-a-kind gift to someone you deeply care for? In this private interview with me, you can leave a legacy to your children or grandchildren. Honor your mum or dad or a mentor. The possibilities are endless. To find out more, just click on Gift Podcasts on my website. Now, back to my guest. Can you offer us some healthy daily habits that can encourage healing?
Of course. So I don't want to bore anyone listening in here, but what I recommend from the outset is start to just check in with yourself. That's the first and biggest thing I have to suggest. Where am I? What am I doing? And how do I feel? If you can start on a day-to-day basis by monitoring three things: your energy levels, your stress levels, and if it applies to your condition, your pain levels. I highly recommend starting to build a sense of introspection on how your condition works by saying, okay, today out of 10, I'm about 7 on the stress scale. And because I'm about a 7 on the stress scale, I can see that actually my energy is very low. I'm probably at like a 2 and my pain is very high. Okay. And what you can start to do when you rate these three things is you can ask yourself the next question, which is, what have I done today? What have I done this week? And start to go backwards and see, okay, well, actually today I have maybe gone to the shops. I have, you know, done the groceries. I've cleaned the house. I've picked up the kids from school. I've done a bit of work. And by the end of it, you're kind of looking at this going, well, actually, pre-chronic illness, this would be normal. But post-chronic illness, this is a lot. And it actually makes sense why I'm so stressed right now. So you get to move back a little bit. And what this does is, so for anyone new to this journey who may not know what spoon theory is at this point, but this is where spoon theory can be highly effective in helping you. Now, spoon theory is a beautiful, beautiful concept developed by a lady named Christine Misserandino in 2003, who herself has lupus. And she went through a time also of trying to explain what she was going through to friends and family. And one day she was sitting on the couch with a friend saying, I don't get it, Christine. Why do you have so much energy today, but the day before you didn't? And you can't tell me what tomorrow is going to bring. Like, we might be able to plan everything and you're just going to low-key cancel on me last minute. What's the deal? And so Christine kind of started to introspect and think, and she went to the kitchen and she pulled out a whole bunch of spoons from her drawer. She found 12 spoons. And she sat down opposite her friend saying, okay, I want you to imagine that each one of these spoons represents a task or an activity. It is effectively, in monetary value, one exercise, one physical movement. Okay. And so when you're chronically ill, your spoons on a day-to-day basis are limited. And those spoons you have each day will be dependent on how stressed you are, how much sleep you've gotten, how tired you are, how much pain you're in, what you did the day before, and hence why it's so important to start monitoring those things. So you don't always know how many spoons you're going to get that day. But what you can do is say, okay, today I have 12 spoons. How am I going to use them so that I don't finish my day entirely burnt out? And so she said, okay, cool. Look at these 12 spoons and tell me what you're going to do with them. And so the friend turns and says, okay, well, this is easy. I'm going to take one spoon and we're going to go to work. Christine goes, no. You misunderstood me. I've said every single action is a spoon. Do you want to go to work? Well, let me take one spoon for getting out of bed, one spoon for showering, one spoon for getting dressed, one spoon for eating, one spoon from getting in the car. You've now used 5. You've got 7 left.
Goodness.
What would you like to do next? And this really made her think, oh, I get it. Your energy is limited. And so if this is a new journey to you, or if you're in that part of understanding healthy habits or how to go about this, I highly encourage you to start to understand the spoon theory a bit. If you join our community, I have a huge amount of resources, free resources, based on how you can implement this in your daily life. But effectively start there and start managing those three little reference points against your spoonies so that you can get a better sense of where you are and where you need to be.
Marina, please tell us more about your services. You have mentioned a few things.
Yes.
But for someone who would like to know what you offer.
Thank you so much. So from this year, we have 3 amazing services that we offer. The first is my coaching services. That can be one-on-one or group coaching. This is specifically for people who have got a chronic illness or suffer from chronic pain and are looking to build up their lives post-diagnosis or even pre-diagnosis. The second thing I have is my community. And this community is a beautiful platform. It's run on a WhatsApp space and a Discord space. And through it, I share a huge amount of resources where people can not only engage with them, but engage with others who have similar conditions. Within this community, I also give preference to sharing my podcasts, which I release bi-monthly. That's about 2 a month. And so what we do in there is we allow people to share their chronic illness stories, whatever it is that they may be going through. And then that person who has shared their story on the podcast can then also get the opportunity to speak at our, again, bi-monthly support group sessions that are online. They then also have the opportunity to turn that into an article that's shared on the website. So that whole community infrastructure is a free service we offer for people. And then now, as of 2025, we also have a premium membership to the Heal community. This is a membership where you have all the benefits of the free community, the WhatsApp group, you know, getting to listen to the podcast, joining the support groups, being part of all of our giveaways and all of that. But then you also get a couple of extra benefits. You also then have access to our workshops and can join for our small focus group workshops where we discuss topics. You then also get access to premium products that we release and launch, like care boxes, care packages. So as part of that monthly subscription, you'll receive physical as well as virtual products, and then also get access to all the workshops, and then have a 30-minute recap session with me every month to discuss any questions you have around your healing process. So that's what we have.
Thank you. And is everything available on your website?
Yes, you can go check out our website for all of this.
You can just mention the address, please.
Yes, of course. It's www.healwithmarina.com.
Yes, I'll attach the link to the website to the podcast. And I'd like to mention two more things. The first one is that you offer a free introductory appointment. Is that like a chemistry test?
Absolutely, yes. I think that when you choose a coach, it needs to be somebody that you can relate to. And the same for anybody that I then work with. We need to know that we gel, we get on, we have similar life views, and you actually see and want to work with the community. It's really important that you feel safe and connected. Mm. Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to mention is that you have a free download on your website.
Yes, I do. And it's actually increasing, and we have a whole resource page now where people can download multiple things. So the main one we have, and well, the main two that we've offered so far are, number one, a free resource for anyone who has just been diagnosed on how to go about that initial week or two. And the next one is for the more seasoned chronic illness patient who's gone around town a bit and has potentially developed a bit of a cynical sense of humor, a little bit of a am I allowed to swear?
Yes.
I give no fucks attitude and wants to start to just get on that healing journey from a slightly more down-to-earth perspective.
Thank you. Now, it's time for your fun question. Are you ready?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Marina, if you could have a talented glass blower make you a beautiful glass bowl, which color or colors would it be, and where would you put it?
What a beautiful question. I would have to say that the colors that resonate with me, definitely ones that I've put into my brand, which are a beautiful light blue and an aqua color and a little bit of gold. I love a little bit of gold in there. But those soothing natural colors that you see whenever you look up into the sky or into the sea, that's what I would love. And if I could put it anywhere, it would probably be in my kitchen or in my dining room. I love cooking. I love entertaining. And so those two rooms, I put a lot of love into, and a lot of good personal things happen there, and a lot of memories are made. So that's where I'd want something so special to be.
Thank you. And thank you so much for spending some time with us and offering your story, which I must say is, it's quite something that I think I could use the word blood curling. I listen to all the pain that it involved and the emotional effects that would have over such a long period. And I'm very grateful that you are offering a community to people who may find themselves in a similar position, and that most of all you offer hope. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for giving me the platform and space to share this, for hearing and listening to me, and for hopefully through this helping anyone who might not be in a good space maybe find a little bit of light at that end of the tunnel. So thank you as well. It's been an absolute honor to be on your show.
Thank you, Marina. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. I'd appreciate it if you'd subscribe to this podcast series where you download your podcasts. And if you found this episode helpful, please share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes and for free podcasts and articles on how to live a happier and healthier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, just search for Mariette Sneeman Journalist. The podcast series, Calm, Clear, and Helpful, is produced by me with original music by Mart Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9:00.